Art Papers expands the dialogue around contemporary art and culture by exploring the ways they affect and reflect human experience. You can find a rich archive of interviews, reviews, feature essays, artist projects, and more on artpapers.org. Welcome to this month's episode of Echoes, a monthly series where we spotlight our community of contributors, the writers and artists who've been central to Art Papers' creative and rigorous coverage over the years. This month, we have a conversation between Christopher Robert Jones and Logan Lochner. They discuss the film Blue by Derek Jarman, the focus of Christopher's contribution to the summer 2021 issue Speculative Masculinities. Christopher's piece was titled Blue Cripistemologies in and around Derek Jarman. Christopher and Logan also discuss the films of Marlon Riggs, specifically Tongues Untied and Black Is, Black Ain't. They consider how all these films, along with other works, are being historicized, how this process is happening with the works themselves, but also with the cultural phenomena they are responding to. The texts they're discussing are linked in the description, and there's also a link if you'd like to support the work of Art Papers by making a donation or purchasing from our shop.
Hey!
Hey!
Welcome, welcome. This is a contributor conversation for Art Papers. My name is Logan Lochner, and my interlocutor today, Christopher Robert Jones. Welcome. How are you doing?
Pretty good. How about you?
Great. Am I too zoomed in? Should I back a little bit? Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us today. I guess we'll just wait for a second to give a few more folks time to join. I guess I should say that we're discussing today Christopher's piece in the summer 2021 issue of Art Papers, among other things. But just to let you know, that piece is available to read online and is also available if you want to order a copy of the magazine itself. So maybe we could start out just talking a little bit about Derek Jarman's Blue in general. Like if you wanted to maybe talk about sort of how you first encountered the piece or encountered the film or Jarman's work more generally and sort of what led you to start asking the questions that led to this piece.
Yeah, so I think in like my more formative years or first kind of being exposed to queer filmmaking or queer art in general that was important to me. I think I came into it with a much more, an attraction to the more like antagonistic, you know, like, I mean, John Waters was like immediately a major, I mean, as it is for so many, but I think in that period, I really didn't know what to do with Derek Jarman in many ways. I think I dismissed it for a long time, I think, as like not for me or something that I didn't really fully understand and maybe from a time and place that I just didn't, you know, vibe with in some way. Mm-hmm. So it kind of, I came back to Derek's work later, particularly through the films that he made in the later half of his career when he started bringing back in a more prominent way, like Super 8 footage and like leaving the more kind of traditional narrative structure towards these kind of moments and washes of experience. And so then I don't know, I was trying to remember exactly why I started thinking about Blue again, but I think I'm sure that it was to do with the pandemic, certainly. And well, for a variety of reasons, I started looking at images of the Prospect Cottage again, quite a bit, as we were, in initial lockdown inside a small apartment with a, you know, with a young child. I just was trying to place my mind elsewhere on more open spaces with like a broader horizon, literally. But there was a lot of response, I think, earlier in the pandemic that I was trying to make some sense of. Like, I was seeing a lot of people, I think maybe more specifically, like an older generation of gay men, like expressing an anger that I thought was complicated and interesting. Like a lot of comments, like angry at the way that the government had responded on a quicker timeline to COVID than HIV. And I don't know, it was so like interesting and complicated to me in this way that I started, I don't know, I guess I felt, I don't know, I can understand those feelings too. But I started looking more to what a Crip discourse or Crip epistemology, like how that could come into the conversation and answer some of those questions maybe. And then just started thinking much more closely about Blue as like a Crip work and what would it mean for us to like think about it. Should we adjust the way that we think about it? Anyway.
No, that's fascinating. Maybe I'll just mention briefly that I was a fan of Jarman's work, but sort of his overall body of work, even Sebastian, which is his first film, which is entirely in like Latin, well, not perfect Latin, obviously, but I'm sort of fascinated by him as this like difficult filmmaker in a way, in the way that he can be obtuse or challenging, which I think is kind of maybe a little bit of what you were talking about being sort of like a turnoff about his work in some ways too. So you sort of actually ended up going to another question that I had, which was maybe if you could talk a little bit about this sort of epistemological approach that you are employing, just because I think that's such a fascinating term, and the way that it's deployed in the essay is really interesting. So I was wondering if you could elaborate upon that a little bit more.
Oh yeah, sure. So a Crip discourse, or like in a conversation about like what Crip means, which I think is built around trying to deal with intersectionality in all the ways that it complicates and messes up like how we have previously maybe built coalition or built structures of, you know, of relating between people. And that a lot of maybe the impetus for those questions came specifically out of experience around HIV/AIDS, and that being this incredibly urgent and pressing issue, but that was also so distinctly an intersectional issue, and not affecting a exclusive specific group of people, even though it was like clearly branded that way, or that was how it was constructed. Mm-hmm. And that like a epistemology in that way takes seriously, I guess, the complications in embodiment and the sensations around embodiment, and looks towards a way of taking that body knowing maybe more seriously, or like as a starting point. And as much as that work was narrativized as a portrait, a dying last comment before dying of AIDS, and certainly there's some truth to that for sure. I don't know, when I watch that film, or like when I watch many like, you know, Circe powerful works from that time that responded to HIV/AIDS as in all its complications, rather than maybe what only seeing it for what it means in or socially signified in that moment, but like And this, of course, I feel like comes up in the Marlon Riggs pieces that you've written so nicely about, in that they're expressing a epistemological knowledge that's based in the body or based or like a throughness of that experience that I just found really compelling. And anyway, I don't know if that actually answered your question, but
oh no, definitely. I mean, I think certainly this idea of I mean, like, yeah, the phrase body knowledge is really nice in the sense that it's like suggesting this kind of like visceral, somewhat non-intellectual way of knowing, which I think like blue is such an engaging example of that, because it's, I mean, at least when you see the visual version with like the film, it's a constant reminder for the entire time of sort of like the physical experience of looking and watching. And so even though it is sort of uninterrupted and monotonous in a certain sense, it's also very alive and potent in that way. But I was really struck by the way that you wrote about the way that like discourse around blue has often been framed as sort of like directly representative of Jarman's loss of his eyesight as the disease continued. And sort of reading it instead as a sort of experiential or like phenomenological experience, as opposed to sort of a direct representation, feels so much more generative and fruitful. But I was wondering maybe if you could, if you know of any other examples, or if you could just speak a little bit more about the ways in which interpretations like that can sort of neuter a work or simplify it or reduce it, because I thought that was something in the earlier part of your essay where you talked about how sort of even the project of like retrospective making and sort of canon revision can also function as this kind of like taming of more sort of radical or potentially radical artworks.
Yeah. I think there's this conversation that's on the internet, on Vimeo or something, that took place at the Renaissance Society in Chicago, which is on the campus of the University of Chicago. And the conversation was between the artist Irina Hedek, and who's like a Serbian-American artist, I believe, and Carrie James Marshall, the painter. And also the writer theorist W.J.T. Mitchell, and sort of I don't know actually what the purpose of the conversation initially was like imagined as, but it brought together Irina and Carrie, and in this fascinating way where Carrie's whole the thrust of that work is, in a certain way, is like the image is everything, or dealing with the structure, the idea of the canon or the structure as something real to take seriously, to affect and change the course of, or intervene upon. And then Irina comes at it with this complete, and the Western image regime is like deleting my culture. And I believe in like an anti-image, or like, I want to corrupt the Western image. And anyway, I totally recommend watching it as a thing, because it's a fascinating, because they're both they have a lot of admiration for each other's work. So it's, but they sort of start to articulate how they are working towards a similar goal, or they have a similar interest, but that they're like obviously coming at it from very different perspectives. And, that conversation specifically kind of continues to strike me in the way that that doesn't allow, like, we don't have, or maybe it's not practiced enough, but in terms of art exhibitions or curatorial structures or something, like a way to bring that complication together and like let it play out. But I like that idea. I mean, Irina's ideas around kind of like what the margins of like what we think of as visuality. So not like you know, photographic image or a painted image necessarily, but like what other things are like interfering and impeding upon. I mean, that has negative connotation to it, but like what other things produce a visuality, or how might we like imagine that differently? And yeah, I don't know. I think blue like ends up challenging that or working along those lines in interesting ways. But I guess I even mentioned that conversation, and I'll shut up about it, but mentioned that conversation in that I don't like thinking about the only way to deal with that. If the image is a problem or something, the only way to deal with it is like in a negative or subtractive way. Like I like that also Kerry James Marshall saying like, well, the image is, you know, it means something in this context. And there's like a position where more image is, you know, appropriate or needed. And in other places, like less image. And yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that is a fascinating, I definitely want to seek that out because that's a fascinating, like intersection between approaches. And especially because, I mean, it sounds like they do have respect for each other's work. So the sense of, being able to appreciate an approach that is not the one that you employ yourself and sort of the conversation and tension that can arise from that. That sounds fascinating.
Right.
Yeah, and one other thing, which maybe if we do want to talk a little bit about like Riggs and Jarman together.
Oh, yeah.
Something that you were writing about in your essay was about like reading Blue as an autobiographical film. And that was making me think a little bit about Riggs including himself so prominently in his work. And it's interesting because like, in writing about him recently, I found out that his sort of training as a filmmaker was in a more traditional manner, putting himself in front of the camera was like completely unimaginable. And yeah, so this idea that like created by artists with HIV AIDS, or maybe just works created by artists who are marginalized for whatever reason, this tendency to read those works as inherently autobiographical and the ways in which artists either engage with that intentionally and sort of use it as a tool, which I feel is kind of a little bit of what Riggs is doing. Although I think he was also so ahead of the curve that it was partially, I don't know. I would just be speculating, but I think it was also just genuinely like self-expression and embrace of self as much as it was a sort of artistic strategy. But yeah, so I'm just interested maybe your thoughts on that. And I think that even the point that you're making about this conversation between these artists at the Renaissance Society actually plays into that, because it's this idea of, you know, the having a sort of figure, whether it's a figure in the case of like Kerry James Marshall, or just thinking about the ways in which visuality and representation can either be liberating or a trap, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And the ways in which reading work as autobiographical can also play into that dynamic, I guess, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm specifically even thinking of, like, Black is, Black ain't, in that way where... Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's like, in a certain way... That's such a strong or like open self-representation, speaking directly from hospital bed, is like, but in some way, like, that just provides this like layer or like lens to that work rather than essentializing it through that or reducing it in some way. And I don't know, like, there's parts of, I think Marlon Riggs' works in particular is like mysterious to me in that way, where there's certain ways where it is like so imaged, or where in somebody else's work, like that image, the image of the body or whatever, a literalizing of something can kind of like totally empty out, not empty out, but you know what I mean? Like reduce, reduce or restrict like the interpretations. But, and I don't, maybe it's, it is the way that he like weaves together like the lyrical and like and that humor comes in like unexpected places, and then all of a sudden it kind of drops into this like really like beautiful, like heavy, complicated thing too. I don't know.
I think that like for me the collage technique that he employs is so important. And it's kind of hilarious because, like, in some ways, in that sense of, like, the actual visual qualities, like, Blue and Tongues Untied, for example, like, could not be more different.
Right, right.
but they're both emerging from this sort of specific context. But, yeah, something else, as we were talking, that I just sort of realized, both filmmakers made works that were either for public television or at least shown on public television, which is a kind of fascinating thing too. I am kind of recreationally fascinated with sort of some of the filmmakers and films that were like coming out of Channel 4 in Britain in the 80s in particular, because it just feels, I think, for me as someone who grew up like in the late 90s, early 2000s in America, like the idea of some of those things being made for public TV is like mind-blowing. But one thing that I was fascinated to learn, actually sort of in a similar vein in your piece, was that Blue was originally released in multiple formats, which I didn't know that before, but it actually makes so much sense. And I love the idea of it being like a radio program as well as being a film that you can go see or see on Channel 4 or whatever.
Yeah. And I mean, it's also like that part became important to me and also confusing in the way that whenever I would see images of the, of Blue, like reproduced in like a magazine or book or something, it would either be just the, you know, just the solid Blue screen, but most often it would be stills from the like the, it's like the last test of the soundtrack that they were doing, where there's somebody, a figure standing in front of the Blue screen, like,
oh wow.
So for, because I hadn't, before I'd seen it, I'd seen those images and I was like, oh, so maybe it's not entirely Blue, maybe like this figure like moves in front of the Blue screen at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And then to find that that didn't happen, I was just so curious by the like, what is the, what's the anxiety around like allowing it to live in that multiplicity, and or the anxiety around like the Blue image being like boring or whatever. And also in that way, like, most of the times that I've seen it, I've watched it with the captions on, which also changes it in some way. But yeah, I don't know. That the mysterious communication, though, between, I don't know if it's communication, I guess, but the similarities between the Marlon Riggs and the Derek Jarman are really fascinating. I actually, like, let me see if I can find it, but I wrote, the other day I wrote down, there's a, in Tongues Untied, he says something like right near the end that I found to be like, oh, there, like there's a very similar version of that in Blue. Mm-hmm. And he says, I listen for my own quiet implosion, but while I wait, older, stronger rhythms resonate within me, sustain my spirit, and silence the clock. And then there's a part in Blue near the beginning where he's talking about Bosnia or the news from the Sarajevo, and he says What need of so much news from abroad, while all that concerns either life or death is transacting and at work within me?
Mm-hmm.
But there's like, maybe even thinking from Tongues Untied into Black Is Black Ain't, like the way that those works, or the way that the work is like, it doesn't shift exactly, but it's like trying to reconcile those like very pressing, acute, urgent, like of the world concerns and responding to like context, like right in that moment, mm-hmm. and this kind of like something coming from somewhere else, on a different scale or in a different kind of temporality or something.
I think, yeah, so much to say about that. well, I mean, I think one thing, that what you were saying made me think of, was that, yeah, for all their visual difference, something that especially, for example, like Tongues Untied and Blue have in common, and I guess I'm kind of pairing them in my mind and in this conversation because they were shown alongside each other this summer at David Zwirner.
Right.
But this like common interest in like language and wordplay and poetry, which had long been, and it's just interesting also because Tongues Untied is such an early Marlon Riggs film, whereas Blue was Jarman's last film. So I think that also mm-hmm. makes them interesting to talk about together. But I mean, poetry had been an interest for Jarman for a long time. And like, in some ways, Blue in that sense reminds me of The Angelic Conversation, which is like Judi Dench reading Shakespearean sonnets.
Right.
Over like very homoerotic imagery. And it's also just interesting because apparently what I learned when I interviewed Vivian Kleiman, who was a collaborator of Riggs's and co-founded Signifying Works with him, which was his production company, is that originally Tongues Untied was supposed to be just like a short sort of exercise. Where he was just going to be making these videos of friends of his who were poets reading poems that they had written, so like Essex and Pill, people like this. And then he actually received his HIV diagnosis like while the project was like just beginning to get underway. So in a very direct sense, it like shifted the tone of the project. And according to Kleiman, it was sort of like that moment and that impulse that like sort of compelled him to come out in front of the camera and like directly show himself in that sense. But yeah, I think another thing that I love about Tongues Untied in particular in those opening sequences is seeing him dancing. And it was really striking to watch, you know, sort of after seeing that image, to watch the beginning of Black Is Black Ain't, where he's so emaciated, like in the woods. And it's just striking because it's a reminder of like how physically small he was as a person. Like it's just something that I noticed, when writing about his work and like watching these films over and over the summer. Because I don't know. Yeah. It was just something that just like that human, just like, seeing him in that human way of just like, oh, this is just like a person who, you know, I don't know. I'm not very tall myself, so I'm just thinking like, oh, we would be like the same, you know, like these sorts of
right,
things.
Right, right, yeah.
But yeah, that sort of vulnerability that he allowed himself to have is just like one of the most striking things about the work that was produced in that period, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. In the catalog that was produced for the like big Jarman shows in Ireland and the UK in like 2019, there is an interview with Isaac Julian, because they knew each other, and obviously Isaac Julian is like a very known quantity and important. And it's like a funny interview, and I'm like worried that I'm like about to totally betray the actual content of the interview, but they keep asking these questions that are kind of like, so like Derek Jarman was like revolutionary, right? Like, he was so important to all you guys, right? And, like, almost in every single response, Isaac Julian's kind of going, like, no, I mean, like, we were, he was doing cool work, and we were friends, but, like, there was a lot of people working at that time. Like,
right.
There was a lot of work being made at that time, and Derek was, like, one of them. And at a certain point in the interview, he says something, I wish I could remember exactly what it was, but he was sort of like, you know, Derek, like, knew how to, like, put, like, he knew how to get attention and, like, how to use it. And I don't know, that it, interesting in that, like, almost, like, reversed in a certain way of the Marlon Riggs approach, where, like, he's not, like, focusing on himself in these other pieces and is this, you know, from this journalistic documentarian kind of point of view that then feels the urgency and then, like, puts, you know, puts himself in front of the camera in that way that is important. And, I mean, Derek, I guess, continued to put himself in front of the camera, but that, interestingly, the way that, I guess, Blue doesn't do that.
Right. And it's interesting, I don't know, something else that I'm fascinated with is sort of the way that these figures, I mean, these two in particular, but then also I think it's happening on a broader scale, especially to, like, queer figures of previous eras, possibly, this sort of, like, historicization that's happening, or, which, because, I mean, and it's kind of what we chatted about a little bit earlier in terms of, like, museums taming work, but I think it happens more generally, like, within the culture outside of just within institutions, but the way that, like, just even the fact that, like, David Zwirner, like, presented these two works together is really fascinating to me, just sort of, like, as a curatorial decision, which I think was great, but it's just, like, interesting that that's how it happened, and also that, like, the name of the entire exhibition series is taken from Angels in America, so, like, it's already placing it, I don't know, like, just, like, all these conversations about, like, who gets to provide the titles for exhibitions about HIV/AIDS and who gets to be sort of, like, featured and included. I don't know, just, like, all those sorts of ways in which those narratives that were so and continue to be so urgent and visceral and embodied for so many people are kind of simultaneously being, like, historicized, sort of codified into, like, academic history, which totally sort of dilutes the urgency of some of the sort of, like, calls to action that the work is making itself, and also sort of, as you pointed out in your essay, like, creates this false narrative that, like, HIV/AIDS is over, like, HIV/AIDS is retro. And I thought that was really, really interesting to think through in terms of, it's important that we show this work and talk about, like, these figures and their history and their legacy, but we also don't want to, historicize what is actually an ongoing situation, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's still kind of perplexing to me, and in the way that they seem, obviously, like, HIV/AIDS as an issue and COVID-19 are very different, but that the structures and inequity that they, you know, underline in a major, major way have relationship to each other, and that those... It's strange to me how they're, like, in many ways can be sealed off from each other. They, like, we aren't able to re-examine or re-discuss a lot of aspects of those works that still, like, they asked questions that we have not adequately responded to, you know, many, many years on. And, yeah, I don't know. Like, yeah.
I mean, even formally, that's something that's really interesting to me about like Tongues Untied is that, you know, it's like a black gay filmmaker. It's like an experimental documentary that is like visually collage. Like, and I'm just like, are you describing a work that's like made last week or, you know, like 30 years ago? So formally and sort of in terms of the sort of narrative or content of the work, it feels so ahead of its and that's just, yeah, like that's just interesting to think about for me, like in terms of it's being historicized while also being like groundbreaking and still relevant. And like you said, I guess that's what reminded me, like you said, those issues and questions that it's asking are not resolved. And the structural inequities, those questions are still ongoing and those struggles are still ongoing like they were when he made this film. So,
yeah. So there's the Greg Bordowitz show, I Want to Be Well, I think it's up
yeah.
at PS1 now.
Yeah.
And was at in Chicago at the Art Institute before that. And I think it came from Reed College or something. I forget exactly where it came from. But that one was interesting, too, in the way that, I don't know, I'm still kind of, like, I'm still questioning, like, how that the relationship to the that historicization works in that way. Because it is, like, the part of it is the banners that say the AIDS crisis is still beginning. And that there's parts of that show, like, part of it is these big bookshelves with his like mm-hmm. his books, and there was really, and I don't know if they've reconfigured it in New York, but in Chicago there was like a recent art catalogs that were still in the Saran wrap, like unopened catalogs, like or they're at, near the top of the shelf. There's like space, like big gaps in like for more space for more books, and mm-hmm. but at the same time is displaying kind of artifacts from, you know, ACT UP, and, you know, like all this, it's in a historical, you know, in a vitrine mm-hmm. way, like threading a narrative, and obviously that's, you know, responding to his body of work and like what he does. But it was interesting because I, you know, like I would hear when I visited anyway, you'd overhear people referring to him like he had died. Like the assumption mm-hmm. was mm-hmm. that he was dead.
Right. Like,
this yeah. is about AIDS. Of course, he's dead.
Right.
That's how it goes. But then these weird sort of subtle parts that pushed against that, like, I don't know.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, wondering how these subjects are, like, even in the David Zwirner show, like, yeah, how are these subjects allowed to exist within an exhibition, and, like, are these people or works, like, allowed to be alive in the way that, you know, not just, like, literally or allowed to exist, but, like, are they allowed to continually complicate or...
mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, when does that bracket become, like, profoundly frustrating to deal with? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm surprised that we have arrived at this place or if I'm like, oh, this was destiny. But I think we have to talk about the David Wojnarowicz outfit. Because I'm like, wow, it's actually at the Met Gala. Do you know, did you see the picture of Dan, I guess it was Dan Levy's outfit?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because, like, that feels like, wow, this is, like, the perfect example of an artist with HIV/AIDS who made work about that, like, being sort of commodified in the worst way, just in the sense that it was a bad outfit more than anything. Like, I don't know, but, yeah, I don't,
yeah.
Maybe just to, like, if anyone doesn't know, the Met Gala was earlier, was that just earlier this week or last week? But Jonathan Anderson designed an outfit incorporating two works by David Wojnarowicz, Yeah, and it was just kind of, I heard multiple sort of takes on it. Obviously, there was just like the cringe factor of the outfit itself. And then like the sort of this gross, like this artist who sort of was on the margins of society and the art establishment for most of his life and career, like turning that into a luxury outfit to be worn into the like Sackler wing of the Met. Right. But then when I was like kind of shitposting about that in my Insta story, someone replied and was like, well, at least like people are Googling him and seeing his work who may have never learned about it before. And I'm like, okay, I mean, that seems like a sort of really generous response, but I can see some credit to that. But yeah, I don't know if you, maybe this is just like a tangent that I thought was amusing, but it just seemed like such a timely example of, well, yeah, I read a really nice, I guess, blog post about this by a writer named Emily Colucci, who talked about how both sort of the Wonyarowicz look and the AOC tax the rich look became this sort of form of progressive camp, in the sense that like it's camp that is like performing these kind of progressive positions or values, but in this extremely anachronistic context, we might say. Yeah. And I thought that was like a fascinating, it was more than just like singling out the look. It was more like drawing a larger argument. And I thought that was really fascinating. I think Emily Colucci is her name, I'm pretty sure. So yeah, maybe check that out if you're interested.
Yeah, that outfit is so funny. And I was really enjoying the comments of like, love the art, but hate the outfit. Just yeah. can't take it.
I mean, yeah. The same house did Wonyarowicz t-shirts a few years ago, and I don't understand why you wouldn't just wear the t-shirt with like fancy Levi's if the theme is America or whatever. But
right,
no one asked me. I didn't get invited. Yeah, I guess we should also say that if anyone has any comments or questions, you can put those in the comments on the Instagram Live and we can answer or engage those. But yeah, so we were talking about the historicization and neutering of these works. I don't know if there was anything
I don't know.
You wanted to say there.
Oh, yeah. I don't know why it makes me think about it, but it's making me think about that the interview conversation that you had with Jared Buckheister, Trouble, and sort of specifically that idea of, I don't know, I'm sort of blanking on the term, but the template.
Arousal template. Yeah,
arousal
that was
template.
Such a good phrase, yeah.
Yeah. And, like, that aim to kind of deal with the complexity and, like, raw experiential body data before it like becomes interpolated by your like, you know, goes through the the structuring process, and that's like a really interesting place to deal with it. And I guess maybe I'm even thinking about it related to like on that, maybe that's like where some of those things are originating, and then like the far end of the arc is where it becomes the Met Gala outfit, like on the way other side. And and that, like, is there a way for those to like touch each other, or like is that an unreasonable ask or something, that it doesn't need to be you know, packaged and polished in those specific
ways. I see what you mean. Yeah, okay, I see what you mean. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think for the context of the Met Gala specifically, I'm skeptical, because it seems like even if something is a really artful and sophisticated and interesting package, it's still going to be packaged in that context. So I don't think it's ever going to have the kind of like inchoate formlessness that I think Jared is kind of trying to capture. But I do think the idea of trying to find some sort of middle ground there is really interesting. And I guess, like, if we think about blue again, I guess, and like how that can be like an experience of a kind of like queer interiority, that feels to me a little more related to that kind of like arousal template experience of it being sort of interior and automatic and allowing for contradiction and multiplicity in this really like generative way. Whereas on the other end of the spectrum, something like, I don't know, like the Met Gala outfit, that just feels so contrived and constructed, even if it is allegedly coming from this space of like art and, you know, queer expression or whatever.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I get the point of view that's like about, well, it's consciousness raising, or it like points people towards that artist and they should go check it out. And of course that, you know, representation does that, or functions that way. But I guess I start thinking about the way that, you know, a marginal point of view is related to through either like fear or pity or inspiration, and like is kind of just toggles between those, and that interiority is like a space that those things don't maybe exist very easily in. And that like it's, you know, it's great. I mean, however, I don't know, at the same time, which I think actually that's like a thing that Essex Hemphill says in Black Is Black Ain't, where he's like, well, whatever makes your spirit rise, like whatever gets a person thinking about it, I guess is fine, but, or, you know, dealing with it is good. But yeah, I don't know. I wish that there was more ways for it to like splinter off and fracture in like more interesting ways, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, maybe to that end, I'm not trying to be cheesy, but to that end, if anyone watching has not seen the works of Marlon Riggs or Derek Jarman, please go check them out. I hope this serves as a impetus in that very generous sense. But I was just going to say, like, explicitly that Criterion released a big box set of Marlon Riggs earlier this summer, and I think those films are still on the Criterion channel if people have those logins. And then I was just going to say for everyone that Blue is currently on YouTube, and it might be removed at some point, but if you would like to watch it, it's on YouTube.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And you can also, it exists in text and audio too, like across the internet in various ways. So
yeah, I want to try listening to just the audio version soon.
I started like when I, over the summer, when I would be taking walks and it would be like really, really hot out and I would start feeling like overwhelmed by the heat, I started switching, listen to like the first 20 minutes of it as just audio. Mm-hmm. In that way that it's just sort of present and like speaking so directly. But yeah.
Nice. So we're nearing the end of the hour. I don't know if anyone has any questions or comments, or if you had any like last points or things you wanted to say.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it may be just a complete like diversion, but another thing that came up in your conversation, the male trouble conversation, that I was just curious about, was you were talking about the Christopher Isherwood Berlin stories and the which I have not read and need to. But Cabaret as a film was something that, like, as a very young person, I, like, came across on television, like, in the middle of a day.
Magical.
And was like, completely mesmerized by, and also like it was that strangeness but also like an intimacy that was like very, I don't know, interesting and powerful and kind of mysterious. So I was just curious if there I need to read that book. But.
Well, I guess, yeah, so the Berlin story, it's technically like two novellas. I felt like I maybe should have given more specificity in describing it in the interview, but like it's technically two novellas. So the paragraph that I'm talking about is the beginning of the second novella. So it's not actually the beginning of the book anyways. But yeah, the protagonist talks about, like, I am a camera is one of the lines. So it's like this idea of like collapsing queer consciousness into this sort of like photographic visual logic. And I thought that was something that Jared's photographs just like really, really captured in a very like distinct and visceral way, I think, for me as a viewer, and also I think for him as an artist, it sounds like. But yeah, I love those stories. Christopher Isherwood is a great writer, like really, really, really excellent prose stylist. And it's just fascinating to me that that work has sort of lived on in these multiple iterations as a play, as a musical, and then as the movie musical, which I think is probably, I mean, obviously how you encountered it and how most people have. And I just love, again, it's like that idea of like queer history or like queer lineages, and how they take these sort of like detours or unexpected twists and turns. And that's fascinating to me. Sarah said in the comments that maybe you had a question about the biennial review, which I'm not trying to prompt you to ask me about my writing, but I am curious if you have a question.
I don't think a specific question. I just like the review a lot.
Oh, thanks.
And it seems like, yeah, I don't know. I like wish that I saw the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe that new exhibitions opened at the Contemporary this past weekend, which I have not seen yet, but it was great. And it was just like great to be back in a space that I had spent so much time in and had been so important to me. And like, after not being in public for, you know, a year, it was just nice to be back. But yeah, it was a great show. And it's just wild to me that it's been, that there have been three iterations of it since the biennial came back in 2016, because that was like when I was just starting as an art writer. So that still feels like such a big event in my mind, but yeah.
It seems like a valuable biennial to have in, I don't know, for it lately it's just been on my mind, especially maybe even like around some of the things we've talked about today, like the New York of it all and the function of, you know, like the, especially with the kind of decentering power of like the pandemic area, you know, the pandemic time.
Yeah, we all know how to be remote now.
Right. And that I was sort of not excited by, but liked the idea that focus could shift towards other places saying other important things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was just happy about it in that way.
Yeah, it's interesting because like it's a biennial in name, but almost like that's sort of like the only consistent biennial quality it has. It's not necessarily every 2 years. There were like massive, you know, like decade long gaps. And even though it's called the Atlanta Biennial, many of its iterations have included artists from all around the South. So I do love the way that it like takes on this sort of institutional form, but then also like doesn't at the same time always. So
yeah,
it's fun because of that. But I guess we should maybe say our parting comments. But it has been so wonderful chatting with you. And I hope we get to talk again soon.
Yeah, same. Thanks for talking.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Thanks so much. Bye, y'all.